Hello. I'm very honored to be here addressing the UCSB ITP lunch seminar. So my talk today is on some research I've done in collaboration with Brian Forbes, John McGreevy, and Brooke Williams. And well, I shouldn't exactly say done because basically, we really have no results. And I'm mostly talking about a really good title. Almost everything I say today, you should assume, is something which I don't really know is true, but I kind of want to be true. And I think maybe it's true based on some sketchy. Based on some sketchy calculations we may or may not have done or told each other we had done. Some of these things maybe have some percentage chance of being true. So the motivation is what's wrong with conventional compactification scenarios, basically Hedderodic and Calabi-Yau. I'll mostly be talking about actually thinking about type 2 on a Calabi-Yau, but all of this is very easily heteroticizable if no. Oh, no. Heterotizable if necessary. And I say if necessary because one may not even have to do that, and I'll get to that later. The main things which the most obvious things which are phenomenologically grossly incorrect about heterotic compactifications are the lack of supersymmetry breaking in the matter engaged sector, although maybe this will work out. The cosmological constant problem. This is a biggie, and I'll have nothing to say about this at all. I'll have maybe a little bit to say about this, but the main thing I'll talk about is moduli fixing. And I sort of feel like I'm carrying coals to Newcastle, coming here and talking about fixing moduli, but the mechanism I'll be talking about, if there does turn out to be a mechanism, is different than recent ones which have been thought about, because the mechanism I'll talk about really does not involve any kind of fluxes or strong coupling phenomena, or really anything outside of anything which is conceptually alien to conventional string perturbation theory. So when I say moduli problem, I mean I'm not going to include fixing the dilaton, although that's something which can also be fixed with the kind of mechanism I'll be talking about. But the point is that the two can be separated here. You don't need to think about these problems at the same time. So the moduli I'll be thinking about fixing are the geometric moduli of the Calabi-Yau, and the main one I really want to focus on is the volume modulus. And so there's just an a priori conceptual problem with Calabi-Yau compactification, which is that the volume modulus is unfixable, at least in perturbation theory, because there is always, if you write down a sigma model, so uh, If you write down a sigma model where G obeys the Einstein equations or obeys the killing spinner equations, then, well, you can always scale up G and you'll get another space which still has the same property. And so, and as you scale it up more and more, you're safe from string corrections. And so you know that you just cannot fix the volume modulus in conventional Calabi-Yau compactification. Now, you might think that this modulus could get potentials in heterotic string theory from small corrections. But whatever kind of potential it gets will always want to roll up to large volume, because whatever potentials you get will go away as the volume becomes large. Because we know that in the limit where the volume is infinitely large, you recover maximally supersymmetric 10-dimensional string theory, and those potentials have to vanish. Okay, so this is just something which conventional string perturbation theories don't know how to deal with. Now there are some perturbative string theories which can solve this problem, but they're not really geometric string theories. So we have asymmetric orbifolds. So consider, for example, T6 and then just reverse the sign of all of the torus coordinates, and at the same time do a world sheet parity transformation. And this doesn't correspond to any kind of a geometric space. And there's one sort of very easy way you can see this. You are reflecting, you're changing the sign of the right moving modes, but not of the left moving modes. And so you're essentially orbifolding by T duality.
Wait, I thought you were. What you described here is an orientifolder, isn't it?
Excuse me.
Separate reflection on the right and the left.
Yeah, sorry.
On the right and the left.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Right. So you're effectively gauging T-duality, which you know is not a symmetry of general relativity. It's an intrinsically stringy symmetry. It has a space-time scale associated with it. And so if you try and get away from the point where the volume of the torus is self-dual, you know you can't do that because the volume modulus is projected out, in effect. Okay. But now this is a very kind of a special perturbation theory, a special background. It's probably about as special as ordinary orbifolds are in the space of all string compactifications. At least that's the possibility that we want to explore. So what we want to explore is how generic are non-geometric strings? Okay. And we don't have a complete answer to that question at all. So really, the way to answer this question sort of completely would be to solve the conformal bootstrap, okay? Sort of classify all possible superconformal field theories of the appropriate central charge, and sort of see how many of them had limits which corresponded to large volume sigma models. Okay, this is an incredibly hard problem, and we're not even going to touch that. Okay, so what we want to show is that even with some special assumptions that string theories without large volume limits might be fairly ubiquitous. Questions so far?
Basement drill holes are very non-intuitive, right? I mean, for example, orbifolds have fixed points.
Right.
Basement drill holes don't have fixed points because there's no points, but right. they have twisted sectors.
Right.
But if you think for normal orbifolds, we can in general blow them up into smooth spacing. Is that one of the questions you're going to ask, whether a given asymmetric orbifold can in fact be blown up in something geometric?
That isn't how we're thinking of this.
I mean, does this one, for example, have It must have some moduli, even though it doesn't have an overall volume.
Well, it's hard to say, really, so how do you identify a modulus for what would be a resolution modulus for an asymmetric orbifold, after all, since there isn't a singularity? You might say that any massless thing in the twisted sector was...
Right.
But, so let me just say now, we wanted to understand what exactly was the logical connection between the kind of theories we're writing down and asymmetric orbifolds. We actually don't quite understand that yet. It may be that you can interpret these things as some kind of blown up asymmetric orbifold, but I think it's more likely that, so let me just draw a picture. I think it's more likely that the kind of thing you'll be getting So, it's possible to have spaces which have singularities which are locally exactly equivalent to orbifold singularities, but which globally aren't the quotient of any kind of covering space. And what that means, so naively, you would think, well, if you have something which is which has an orbifold singularity, they're twisted sectors, why can't you just gauge twist and get the covering space? And the answer is it's not quite an exact symmetry. So you have twisted sectors that can, in instantons, the world sheet can pull off the space and decay, so you can't gauge twist. It probably is going to turn out, or it may turn out, that these are things which are sort of locally but not globally asymmetric orbifolds, but who knows how to make sense of that kind of idea. So we just have a different approach. Question.
So, I mean, in some sense, the idea of the asymmetric orbifold was to divide the string and pull out the right loopers and do something different.
Right.
So if more generally, could one think of just, taking two conformal field theories, one for the left loopers and one for the right loopers, and try to put them together to make a string, all the constraints. I mean, I'm not sure, I don't remember offhand what all the constraints are to make.
I think for a general Calabi-Yau, you don't have this breakup, right, into right movers and left movers. I mean, isn't that special to sort of flat space and tori and things which are locally flat? Yeah, I don't think, I'm not sure, but I don't think you can do that. But I'll just tell you, so the approach is to sort of look at backgrounds which use T-dualities in an essential way, things which wouldn't exist without the existence of T-duality, and that's the sense in which we know that these backgrounds we want to talk about generalize the asymmetric orbifold. But beyond that, it's not totally clear. So let me now explain the sense in which I mean that. So first of all, let's imagine if we just wanted to do a four-dimensional compactification, quote unquote. So okay. So now what does a four-dimensional supersymmetric compactification look like? So there are arguments that four-dimensional supersymmetric manifolds are T2 fibered. So what that means in practice is that you have some base space, usually a sphere, and that you have what is sort of locally a direct product of of the base space with a torus, but the size and shape of the torus are changing, and at some isolated points they may even become singular tori. Although generically, even when you have these singular tori, the total space is still non-singular. So these don't necessarily correspond to singularities of the entire four-dimensional thing. And also, it's a fact that far from the singularities, the tori are approximately flat. So approximately flat far from the degenerate points. And that sometimes gets referred to as the semi-flat approximation. So it's essentially the approximation in which we use eight-dimensional effective supergravity. And we know that eight-dimensional supergravity breaks down at some points, but most places we can use it. And that's really the approach that we'll be using, is just using the lower dimensional effective supergravity obtained from reduction on tori and looking for solutions of that with various boundary conditions. In particular, supersymmetric solutions of that. Now, so the key question is how these tori behave. I don't really want to say near the singularity, but as you go around the singularity, what do these tori do? So in general, you have some metric on the torus, which is we'll call Mij. So I'll use capital letters for the torus directions, for the fiber directions, lowercase letters for indices for the base directions. And as you go around, the tori come back to themselves, so the metric on the tori comes back to itself only up to transformation by a large coordinate transformation. Okay. Now, so how do we interpret that statement in terms of the eight-dimensional supergravity? Well, in the eight-dimensional supergravity, let's say we start with maximally supersymmetric 32 supercharged supergravity in 10 dimensions. We reduce on a T2, and in the eight dimensions, there's a duality group and let me restrict to the perturbative duality group by which I mean duality transformations which fix the dilaton. So this can all be made arbitrarily weakly coupled in the sense of
A to B, or does it matter if you're going to do this?
Yeah, it doesn't matter at this stage anyway. In fact, you can even think of bosonic string theory for now, because all of these duality the only fields which are ever going to be turned on are the NS fields. So there's actually only one difference that question makes, which is that let me come to that in a second. So we have some duality group, some SL2Z group of discrete symmetries, which corresponds to large coordinate transformations of the space you've reduced on. Okay, so that's fine as far as it goes, and solutions, especially sort of supersymmetric solutions of the Einstein equations of this form. Are extremely well understood. They've been, well studied. All the behavior of the singularities is understood. The result, I'll just quote, is that for absolute value of a trace of t less than or equal to 2, there's always a supersymmetric solution in the vicinity of the singular point. Okay, so there also exists an infinite hierarchy of non-supersymmetric singularities with that same monodromy, but there's always one supersymmetric solution. And then for trace greater than or equal to 2, well, those singularities have also been thought of, but
they can occur in supersymmetric magnification.
They can occur, but they're never a single singular point in the base, as you know, because a lot of this work was worked out by DeWolf, Zwieback, Iqbal, and some other people. And
Thomas Schauer.
Sorry, people I forgot. Sorry. Right. So there are also things outside of this range which are supersymmetric, but they're not actually point-like in the base. But and we might want to consider things like that too. But just for simplicity. But yeah, we really want to generalize this in a slightly orthogonal direction, which is that in string theory, as opposed to supergravity, the duality group is bigger than this. Even the perturbative duality group, it's actually SL2Z cross SL2Z on the two torus. And the extra elements come from T-duality and B-field shifts. So one can shift the period of the NS-NS B-field through the T2 fiber by 2 pi, and there's no physical effect. And then, so the one thing I wanted to say is that in superstring theory, what you really want to look at is a subgroup of index 2. So sort of only half the elements of this group take type 2a to type 2a and type 2b to type 2b. So those are, only half of these are actual symmetries of the theory. So questions so far?
There's not quite every K3 can be written as an elliptically vibrant manifold.
Not
their codimension 1 in the moduli space.
In the moduli space. Not always, right. So not everything, notice I didn't say elliptically, I said T2 fibered. And so it's, the point is there's actually even a little extra nice structure on top of this in the hyperkähler case, which there isn't really an analog in the T3 case, where the extra one parameter basically corresponds to rotating the complex structure by something, because there's a whole two sphere of complex structures.
So in the generalization you're about to make, that will be irrelevant.
Right, there's no elliptic stuff anyway, and there's no sort of special structure on top anyway. And this is, by the way, a big annoyance in terms of actually finding local models for these singularities, because the elliptic parameterization helps incredibly in practical terms in terms of actually writing these things down.
What does that refer to? It refers to Calvary homomorphically, or?
It refers to the fact that the fiber is a complex submanifold of the total space. That really helps you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. And yes, and in that, with that, tau varies homomorphically. Uh-huh.
So some duality interchange the two SL2Z, just 2A, 2B, 2A, 2B?
Yeah, it's on one, if you T-dual on one circle.
You go on one circle, you sit yourself. Okay.
So let's, I'm going to keep that there for a second. Right, so you could imagine, for instance, you start out with, from now on, I'm going to not worry about compactness. So I'm just going to look, for local models. So the base is going to be Euclidean space, topologically. Because, thinking about global structure in the base is really a higher order of difficulty problem. One could easily imagine a point in the base around which, as you transport the fiber around the base, it comes back to itself. Up to a T-duality transformation. So you go around the base, and what you thought was a little circle, a little torus, comes back to a big torus, and winding strings come back to Kaluza-Klein modes, etc. And in fact, it's possible. We know that this singularity makes sense. It's possible to say almost everything about it because it's exactly equivalent, as Joe pointed out. It's exactly equivalent to another element of this SL2Z, which just rotates the torus by 90 degrees. Okay, and so what we usually write down is T89 gets switched around. With this transformation on the torus. And when we have this kind of monodromy for a torus, we know what the physics is. There's a there's an E7 gauge group, a non-perturbative E7 gauge group living at the singularity. So this is
wait, do you want to say more about that? This is similar to how D7 brings Kernath theory, but this is not the same monodromy as a D7 brain.
It's the monodromy of a collection of PQ7 brains, which can be collapsed to a point.
Okay.
And basically, yeah, I'll just say, right. So, on a mathematical level, this is conception. It's mathematically equivalent to F theory, and there's so much supersymmetry that the physics is the same too. Basically, these if you have 2 7 brains that you're bringing together, there is always a light D2 brain. Actually, let me just say something quickly about how to see this physics when it's not the dilaton that's varying, but the shape of an actual torus. So, let's say we have point where the torus degenerates, and the monodromy is say 1 1 1 zero, okay, and we can send in what I'm going to call a PQ1 brain, which comes from a 2-brain wrapped P times around one cycle and Q times around the other. Okay, so it's a 1-brain in the 8 dimensions, and then you can send it towards the singularity and bring it back, and you know that it comes back as a P, comma. P comma P plus Q, 1-brain, yes. But it's also pointing in the opposite direction. Okay, so if you choose Q, such that those two numbers are equal, it can annihilate, and you can essentially lasso this degenerate point. And if you have two of these degenerate loci, you can sort of lasso both of them, but then let that configuration relax, and it minimizes its area by just being a 2-brain stretched between the 2 degenerate loci. And there's another quick, easy thing you can say about this, which is that. Perturbative string theory in 8 dimensions has to make sense, has to be a consistent theory in 8 dimensions, just by considerations of effective field theory. D brains in 8 dimensions effective D-brains in 8 dimensions satisfy current continuity equations. So they can only have boundaries where 8-dimensional supergravity breaks down. So you know that that degenerate loci are potential loci where boundaries for D-brains can live. So and then by supersymmetry, you know that when these degenerate loci are moved together, that the two-brain becomes light. And actually, you can calculate that it becomes a W boson of an enhanced gauge group. Okay. So questions so far? So we know now that that these kinds of singularities which close on T-duality are consistent. We know that they can exist. And now what we can do is we can, and now this one isn't very interesting in some sense because it's equivalent to something known, but you can also just start out, you can start out the theory with some boundary conditions such that the moduli in 8 dimensions only come back to themselves up to some transformation which you know is not equivalent to any element of just a single SL2Z. It's very easy to find such things. Now it may be hard to actually find the solution, and this is something we're working on, but you know that such things have to exist, and this is the sense in which I really want to argue that the kinds of backgrounds we'll be looking at are more generic than Calabi-Yau compactification, or in this case K3 compactification, because elements which monodromy behavior which doesn't fit into a single SL2Z subgroup of the duality group is far more generic than monodromy behavior which does. Okay, but at the same time, the dilaton is left unfixed, and these theories can be made arbitrarily weakly coupled. So even in the category of weakly coupled string theories, we think that sort of Calabi-Yau compactification and things with large volume limits are probably, relatively rare, relatively special. And so I said all that. I haven't said anything yet about supersymmetry. So let me say something about that next.
So there is no moduli problem.
That would seem to be the resolution.
If you represent the product of Z as generator symmetry as a product of two tori, it would seem that you have vibration over the plane with the product of two tori.
Right, but there's really only one torus. I mean.
No, I'm saying if by the chain of dualities it would be some Calabi-Yau.
Yeah. Oh, good. Right. And so in that. By chain of dualities, you mean using F theory? I mean, it is. No, I'm sorry.
It seems to me that you're describing compactification of some four-dimensional manifold because you have a fiber involved with a plane with a fiber.
But I think the chain of dualities that you're using goes through F theory at some point. I mean,
maybe yes.
But in F theory, there isn't an extra modulus for the volume of the extra torus.
So how many dimensions do you compact?
Right now, for this toy model, I'm only compactifying 2 dimensions.
So, 2 plus 2. Oh, yes, but I mean, how many flat directions?
8. 7 plus 1.
So you're compactifying F7 1.
Well, it's not though, because the dilaton is left unfixed.
I don't understand. What is the theory you're starting
with? I'm starting with type 2 string theory in 10 dimensions. And I'm compactifying on a single T2.
But this T2 is fibered over the plane.
That's right.
So you have total of 6 flat directions.
Excuse me. Yes, that's right. Yes.
Okay, but now, yeah, is it possible that this is related, yeah, in some sense to quantification down to full flat direction, not on color BL?
It's not F theory on a Calabi-Yau because the axio dilaton is constant. So there, it's possible that there is some chain of dualities which gets you back to a geometric compactification, but not as far as we know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You do the same for the dilaton. Are you going to combine this later? There are similar things you do with the dilaton, and
that's right. They're just they're less well under control in principle.
Also, you have to worry about the moduli on the base.
That's
right. And again, you sort of want to do the same thing in all directions at once.
That's right. You would want to put, so this the reason why we're talking about just perturbative scenarios is to make it more dramatic. I mean, to point out that even sort of very tame and controllable backgrounds of string theory, which probably have sort of CFT constructions, which we'd like to do. I'll maybe say a little bit about that if there's time, which we don't have yet, which preserve supersymmetry, you know, still don't have large volume limits. But yeah, then one thing you could do is you could sort of do this all for T4 vibrations of a three-dimensional base, and then go to infinite coupling. So you get M theory on a non-geometric G2 manifold, so to speak. And again, you could use these same kind of arguments to just say that would be a fairly generic thing. I mean, the thing I wish I had was sort of a globally sensible solution for these backgrounds, which you could just see that there were no moduli left over. We're definitely trying to find these, and we don't have them yet. But probably they just exist. I mean, let me give an argument that they really should. So,
are you claiming that locally it's obvious they exist, basically brain choice of holonomy?
So I'm well, I don't want to use the word obvious. But
it's
true at least at the level of solutions to eight-dimensional effective supergravity.
In the supergravity solution, what happens? The curvature blows up at those points.
That's right. The curvature blows up at that point. Those points, even for geometric monodromies, the curvature always blows up, and what that means is that the semi-flat approximation is just breaking down. Because even for instance, this monodromy and anything that's conjugate to it corresponds to a smooth point in the total space. So the curvature is definitely not blowing up at this point, even though in the eight-dimensional dimensionally truncated approximation it is. Right. So really, the way to see if these non-geometric singularities made sense would be to find a world sheet conformal field theory that corresponded to them. Let me just say maybe something real quick about the difficulties of doing that. The difficulty is basically that it's the same as the difficulty of finding something that flows to an asymmetric orbifold. So you're basically gauging S duality on the world sheet. So usually the way that one would construct a string theory with some known boundary conditions, but you don't know what the solution is. Usually the way you would do that is to construct a weakly coupled Lagrangian on the world sheet with appropriate field content, and then let it flow to something informal. And then you can there are usually arguments. So actually. I don't remember how to do this in terms of an operator product. But there are symmetry anomaly matching conditions, which essentially guarantee that you're going to flow to something with non-zero central charge, or central charge with at least a fixed value. So you can usually argue for the existence of CFTs like this. The problem with constructing something like an asymmetric orbifold that way is that you're essentially gauging an S-duality on the world sheet, because T-duality is a strong weak coupling duality in two dimensions, and it's essentially impossible to have that as a manifest symmetry of a weakly coupled field theory. But there's one trick one might be able to use. So one might be able to use a linear sigma model based on a higher dimensional field theory. So there is a manifestly S-dual formulation of four-dimensional gauge theory in terms of reduction of a six-dimensional field theory on a T2. And so one might be able to construct two-dimensional theories with T-duality as a manifest symmetry by starting out in four dimensions, reducing on a T2, okay, and then gauging a geometric symmetry of the T2. But this is something that we haven't been able to do. But effectively, yeah, I mean, you just get some tau of z and z bar and rho of z and z bar, which is equal to the volume plus I times the B field through the T2. So there's some effective Lagrangian for a tau, a rho, and the metric in eight dimensions. Okay. And it's just, the monodromy just corresponds to boundary conditions on tau and rho near the degenerate point. And so you can certainly choose to start tau and rho with whatever boundary conditions you want, and then let the system relax, radiate away energy. Oh no, Joe's shaking his head. Is there a problem? Okay. No, but I've seen you kill people's months of work, like with a single casual comment at a seminar. It's traumatic.
You don't have any results, so it's
yeah, I know. I actually do have results, but for the Santa Barbara version, I'm suppressing them, so Joe can't shoot them down. So you can choose boundary conditions that will give solutions like this. It'll be more convincing, harder for Joe to shoot down, if we actually find solutions with those boundary conditions. Yeah.
Well, solutions of supergravity, presumably.
That's right.
So I just want to understand better the nature of the singularity. I mean, you're talking about this sort of local flatness or something, right?
Right.
Do you mean the metric on the torus is not going to be flat? Or do you mean the torus is simply becoming degenerate?
The
circles are shrinking to zero or something.
So let's talk for a second about just the geometric monodromies. So in the semi-flat approximation, where you just take an ansatz where the torus is flat over every point, and then you solve 10-dimensional supergravity with that ansatz. There's just sort of a 1-1 correspondence between solutions of that and solutions of the higher dimensional equations. Then the point is that, how do I write it? Phi kk, so the Kaluza-Klein modes on the torus basically go as e to the minus m8 times r8. So they fall off exponentially with distance to the degenerate point. So basically, the way to say it is that the semi-flat approximation is it's not exactly effective field theory near the degenerate point, because there are extra modes that are becoming light. And the way you can see that is that if you have this monodromy, the torus stays constant volume, but it gets infinitely stretched out. So it looks, the space looks like it's decompactifying in one direction and going to zero size in the other. But what actually happens is that singularity is resolved just through including the non-trivial behavior of the Kaluza-Klein modes. And the way you can sort of see that there's a one-to-one correspondence is, you know, they're heavy. They don't have independent degrees of freedom in them. Okay, but their behavior is non-trivially locked into the behavior of the light modes. Okay.
This is something counterintuitive. When you say you have a vibration, you in general don't have the translational symmetries along the fiber directions. It's a topological statement, it's not a statement about the geometry.
That's right, but it also happens to be a true statement about the geometry far from the scene. Basically, I mean, effective field theory sort of makes you expect that, because what it makes you expect is that there are going to be some solutions to these dimensionally reduced equations of motion. And then, since you can always sort of find them with the right boundary conditions, you don't expect that there are going to be sort of two sensible solutions with the same boundary conditions to the full 10 dimensional equations of motion. So we were confused about that relationship for a while, but so you can't, now of course it doesn't really mean anything to say how do you lift these singularities to the higher dimensional space, because they're non-geometric. So the only real statement you can make is how do you lift a string to perturbative string theory. That's why we'd really like to find a conformal field theory construction of these things. Okay, but until we do, or show for some reason that you can't, which hopefully is not true, we'll just go on the assumption that you can always that there always exists something with those boundary conditions that resolves the singularity. So questions so far? Okay, so and now I'll just talk a little bit about the Calabi-Yau case, or non-geometric Calabi-Yau case, or whatever it is. But there's not that much that's different.
Oh, you mean supersymmetry?
Yeah. Okay. Well,
these arguments would seem like they would equally well work if you didn't have supersymmetry and then you have a de Sitter vacuum.
Right. So I said I wasn't going to talk about the vacuum. I mean, really conceptually, how to deal with vacuum energy. But yeah, they would. Like, I think these solutions are probably also pretty ubiquitous. If you, there's no reason why they should be less common if you. Don't impose supersymmetry.
You still have to stabilize the dilaton.
That's right. Although you could do a sort of non-geometric G2, hopefully, and not have to worry about that either. So now what's the picture of Calabi-Yau's T3 vibrations? So the picture is that if you reduce eight-dimensional supergravity on one more circle, a circle across a hyperkähler space. Now you have R4 cross B, which is of the form like S1 cross something, probably in S2, but cross B prime. And then you have cross T3, but one of the torus directions in this case just isn't involved at all. So in B, it looks like you just have a number of infinite parallel degenerate loci, which are codimension one in the base. But then, of course, you know, you might want to just take these strings and kind of make them join at angles, sort of let them form webs. And it turns out that it's possible to do that in a way that's consistent with supersymmetry. So there are BPS equations which describe you know, the allowed sort of angles and orientations of these degenerate loci in terms of which spinner you preserve and so on. And so the picture is just that sort of quarter supersymmetric string junctions, or they're not strings, they're really forebrains, because there's an R4 also here. But quarter BPS forebrain junctions in seven-dimensional supergravity are Calabi-Yau manifolds. I mean, they correspond sort of one-to-one. It's if you want to think about the compact case, it's a little complicated because you have to sort of understand how these junctions close the space. Yeah.
I'm getting a little confused. So are you saying that there's nothing, there's no point singularity, which would just be some sort of two-duality on the whole T3? Oh, I see. You can't go around the point in three dimensions.
Right.
Okay.
So that's right.
That's the problem.
So because you're, yeah, so let's not even worry about T-duality just yet. So this is the picture for a geometric Calabi-Yau. You have, you do have these codimension three singularities where the things join. Well, you know that they're at least codimension three in the base, and then mathematicians have argued that they're codimension three. The extra singularity you get is codimension three on the fiber as well. So they're codimension six in the whole space, which is sort of what you would expect. When you have actual singularities, right? I mean, generically they're just smooth points. So this is the picture that geometric Calabi-Yaus are quarter BPS forebrain junctions in seven-dimensional supergravity, with monodromy in SL3Z subgroup, of SO3 comma 3Z, which is the perturbative duality group in seven dimensions.
This is supposed to be like one to one. Every Calabi-Yau can be represented this way, and vice versa.
Well, there's an argument that says every Calabi-Yau is supposed to be T3 fibered.
That's the Seale-Schrodinger.
Is as low a result, yeah. And so, in other words, if you have some T3 fibration, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say one to one. It could be many to one. So many junctions could well represent the same Calabi-Yau, and they probably do. But yeah, I mean, if you have any T3 fibration, the T3s degenerate at some loci, and so you can start out the seven-dimensional scalars with some set of boundary conditions, such that, you know, their behavior near that graph on the base is correct, and then the point is just that you can do that. And you can do that. And from that point of view, these things look far more generic than a Calabi-Yau compactification. And you can argue that anything which doesn't lie in an SL3Z subgroup at least doesn't have a large volume limit. There might be a like a compact, completely compact moduli space. That would be kind of interesting. And I don't have any argument that would say that that didn't happen. But anyway, it just seems like this opens up, you know, a class of very physically interesting solutions that you could look at, and we're trying to learn more about it. So I guess I'll let me in there and take questions. So. Yeah, Gary.
So if one tries to find sort of the simplest example of this sort of phenomenon, you might try to do it in three dimensions, right, with a circle over a plane,
right,
and ask if the circle could come, you have a point on the plane and you transport the circle around and the circle comes back to its T-dual transform, small circle goes to big circle.
That's right.
So in that case, does it have sort of some conformal field theory description?
Well, in bosonic string theory, you might be able to get that. That would be kind of interesting to try. You couldn't have that in superstring theory because T-dualing on a single circle isn't a symmetry of any supersymmetric theory.
Even in bosonic string theory, I mean, you're saying your basic, as far as I can tell, supersymmetry was not playing a key role in this idea of generalizing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that might be something interesting to try to get a simple example. Other questions? Oh, although I guess, well, it's no. That could, yeah, okay. I think that could be good. Yeah.
That sounds like an interesting idea. I'd like to know what it looks like.
Yeah, that is an interesting. Other questions? Well, thank you very much.